It's the basement. Welcome to the third episode of It's Debatable, where every week students from the Department of International Relations at the University of Malta discuss a hot topic from current affairs. I am Hilary Briffa, and I will be your host for the next half hour. Today our topic for debate deals with the recent events in Tunisia and is entitled Tunisia, a domino effect? Present in the studios to help us answer this question are Darren Kitkuti and Gorkem Dirik. Today's guest speaker is Dr. Vickiane Cremona, Ambassador of Malta to Tunisia, and Dr. Isabel Callea, Head of the Department of International Relations, who will be our academic advisor. From late December, the widespread Tunisian protests, which led to the ousting of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, have taken a central role on the world stage. As Tunisians witness the rebirth of their country, there are fears among their North African neighbors that their discontent and eventual uprising could spread. With Egypt being a clear example that the Tunisization of the Arab street is more than just a term, what are the possibilities of Tunisia beginning the wave of democratization in the Middle East and North Africa? Before our two students open the debate, I would like to welcome Dr. Isabel Callea, who lectures on political patterns and processes in the Mediterranean at the University of Malta, to give us an introduction about why it has been so difficult for countries in this region to democratize. Dr. Callea. It's debatable.
The Tunisian crisis has gripped the imagination of the world. Seen as the eye of the storm, the events here have inspired dissent across the Arab world and sparked widespread protests. Indeed, Tunisia's uprisings has electrified Arabs across the Middle East and North Africa, where many countries share similar problems of poor living standards and authoritarian rule. Inspired by Tunisia's example, thousands of Egyptians have taken to the streets to demand an end to Mubarak's 10-year rule. In Jordan, protests led by a group of former generals has now spread countrywide and across classes. Yemen, in the last weeks, has seen protests spread from its capital, and riots have also surfaced in Sudan. As far away as China, the regime has instructed its media to only report information on Tunisia released from its official news agency. Tunisia, indeed, epitomizes the political construct and the socio-economic developments of the region, flaunting structures that are out of sync with the modern world, characterized by a paternalistic political order which has encouraged corruption and is supported by a strong security force, while the majority remain marginalized and deprived of political rights. However, Tunisia, like much of the Arab world, has changed. A small country of 10.5 million, a secular state that has promoted the rights of women, it has opened up to the world. There have also been positive developments in education and health, while the economy has grown and is far more diversified than many of the other economies in the region. Till recently, it provided a modicum of prosperity and social peace. Consequently, here we have seen a rise in literacy, growing communication networks, and an emergence of a large urban middle class. Indeed, agreement and the resolve of the middle and working class forces seem to have toppled the old regime with ease and speed. The transitional government, now in place, has already purged many of its old guard, promised the release of all political prisoners, the freedom of the press, the legality of all political parties, and the holding of genuine elections under the gaze of international observers. Questions, however, still abound about the future of Tunisia and the region. One Egyptian rebel on Al Jazeera likened the process to the French Revolution. Closer to home, analysts have been making comparisons with Southern Europe in the 1970s. Here, democratic transition in Spain acted as a catalyst for the region, with Portugal and Greece following suit. But the similarities between the two regions do not stop there. As in many North African states today, in Southern Europe in the 50s and 60s, the region also opened up to the world and was transformed in socio-economic terms, while political access remained limited. Here also, the West had preferred to shore up authoritarian regimes rather than incorporate the communists into the political system. However, in the 1970s, coexistence and the rise of the Euro-communists that emphasized the readiness to work with and respect the parameters of liberal democratic states facilitated the practice of consensual politics and successful democratization. Can this serve as a model of politics in Tunisia and further afield? Tunisia's transition so far has been secular. In Egypt, the Brotherhood will undoubtedly play an important role. However, it contains many moderates who welcome democracy as a better alternative to the present. As in the case of southern Europe, resolving the new Cold War, now coalesced around religious cleavage, will provide the answer to successful democratization in the region.
It's debatable. Thank you, Dr. Kalea. Now let us begin our debate. Gorkem, can you comment on the importance of the role that the people are playing in these events?
The Arab masses will no longer accept what they used to accept. The Arab elites will no longer remain silent. Modernization, globalization, telecommunication, and Islamization have created a critical mass that cannot be stopped. The example of democratic Iraq is awakening others, and Al Jazeera's subversive broadcasts are fanning the flames. And so the Tunisian Bastille fell, the Cairo Bastille is falling, and other Arab Bastille will fall.
Thank you, Gorkem. And Darren, what is your view on the role of the people?
Hilary, when examining the recent public demonstrations which took place along North Africa and the Middle East, it is important to keep in mind the fact that Arabs tend to take to the streets in a bid to express their political discontents rather than channeling it across the respective government structures. Therefore, the recent demonstrations across the region are not an exception in Arab history. The self-immolation of Mohamed Bouazizi, which happened on December the 17th, managed to stir a revolution in Tunisia, which ultimately toppled the regime of Ben Ali. This was possible because of a number of factors such as unemployment, corruption, food inflation, the lack of freedom of speech and the low standards of living, which ultimately came together as one motivating force which enabled the Tunisians to call for change. Naturally, this managed to create a domino effect in the region because people in other Arab states are subject to the same challenges. So once they got the news that the Tunisians were calling an end to the Ben Ali regime, they were encouraged to do the same. However, it is subjective whether all mass demonstrations would ultimately yield to changes within the region.
Thank you, Darren. Gorkem, in this situation, would you consider the stance of the big powers to be contradictory?
This is for sure. There are no excuses for the contradictions. How can it be that Bush's America understood the problem of repression in the Arab world, but Obama's America ignored it until last week? How can it be that in May 2009, Hosni Mubarak was an esteemed president whom Barack Obama respected, and in January 2011, Mubarak is a dictator whom even Obama is casting aside? How can it be that in June 2009, Obama didn't support the masses who came out against the zealot Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, while now he stands by the masses who are coming out against the moderate Mubarak?
Okay, interesting point. Now, Darren, the Jasmine Revolution has been subjectively successful in toppling the regime. Do you feel that other protests in the region would be equally successful?
Hilary, although the Tunisians managed to topple the Ben Ali regime, this doesn't mean that Arabs in other countries are going to be equally successful. The Tunisians themselves still kept protesting following the new formation of government due to the fact that it included members which had previously formed part of the Ben Ali regime. Even more, once Ben Ali fled from Tunisia, he was granted asylum in Saudi Arabia. Until the time we're recording this show, the 10th day of en masse protests in Egypt, Mubarak is still insisting on serving the full term of his office. So change is not implemented that quickly. In the dramatic events which have unfolded in Tahrir Square, we have witnessed how pro-Mubarak supporters have advanced into the square with camels and horses to counteract the masses that are calling an end to the regime. One must also keep in mind the other important challenge which democratization process in the region faces. The fact that although the opposition forces all agree that the regime must go, they appear to be undecided over what should follow next in the transition period, which is subsequently created. So there exists the possibility that the elites form another sort of regime. Also, in the case of Jordan, the monarch sacked the government as a result of the protests which took place and has asked an ex-army general to form a new government. But the monarch himself, he still remains there in Jordan. Gaddafi has also condemned the Tunisian uprising by saying that that this sort of bloodshed which is happening in Tunisia is useless because ultimately another president is going to be elected, and in his view, no other person other than Ben Ali can lead Tunisia in the present scenario.
Thank you, Darren. Gorkem, do you attribute the recent events to the failure of U.S. policy or to authoritarian regimes?
Well, no group, I would like to say no group is watching the events unfold in Tunisia more closely than fellow Arabs, most of whom live under autocratic governments and are feeling the same economic pinches of black job prospects and high food prices. Ali Tahmash, an activist who runs a social media agency in Amman, called it a hunger revolution. Says Tahmash, this is not just about politics and having kind of freedom of speech or religion. This came out of despair. It was because of the economy. Tunisians and Algerians are hungry. The Egyptians and Yemenis are right behind them.
Darren, can you comment on the number of unsuccessful protests which have also surfaced in the region?
Yes, although in Tunisia the people managed to topple the regime, and in Egypt the protests kept on going for at least 10 days of protests. And for example, in Sudan, the police managed to repress and arrest the protesters, and they didn't manage to institute any political changes. In Saudi Arabia, the protests were stopped by the police after 15 minutes from the time they started. In Yemen, on the third day of protests, although a number of human rights activists and the oppositions of the country called for a major protest, and they were expecting a million protesters, only 20,000 people turned up. So there isn't that much of interest in instituting political change. In Oman, which is a relatively stable country in terms of political institutions, they also had protests for salary increases, which ultimately reveals that it's not only about hunger. There aren't common factors which bind the protesters per se, but also people who just want change within the political structure. In Mauritania and Morocco, although there were a number of self-immolations, they proved to be ineffective because they didn't manage to stir up any protests at all.
Thank you, Darren and Gorkem. You both raised some very interesting points. We'll have to stop here for a short break. When we come back, we'll be speaking to Dr. Vicky Ancremona.
News coverage can be relatively limited in capturing the real feel of what is really going on in Tunisia. As someone who's in the country at the time of this major upheaval, what is your assessment of the situation?
Well, with regard to the situation, I think one has to look at two aspects. What led to to what is now being called a revolution, and which a blogger had defined as a Jasmine Revolution, and which seems to have been picked up internationally, and what the current situation is now. Now, what led to the situation, there are the immediate causes and the general causes. The general causes is 23 years of absolutist rule that's disguised as a democracy. I mean, with all the democratic structures in place, with elections and parties and this sort of thing. But which in reality was a very clever way of architecting the whole situation, because these parties were in effect totally ineffective. The ones who actually tried to voice any sort of opposition were immediately muzzled. elections were always proclaimed at a very high percentage of turnout, when in reality it was known that many, many people didn't even have a vote. Although on the outside everything was working as it should work in a democratic state, if you looked at the details very closely, you then realized that this was not the case at all. There was a small group of ministers, some of whom were highly competent and technocratic, but most importantly, there was the figure of President Ben Ali, where ultimately he was the person who decided what was going to happen in the country, and nobody else. I mean, there was very little to say, particularly on major political issues. So this, in the meantime, there were people who were getting very, very rich through corruption, particularly the president's family, and on the other hand, there were people who were very poor, young graduates rather, who had completed their studies at the universities and who came out and formed part of the huge ranks of unemployed, and who couldn't find work. Now, those were the general causes. The immediate causes was a young unemployed worker. He wasn't a graduate, and the reports which went across the world were mistaken. He was an unemployed worker. He lived in a very, very poor town, in a very poor area of Tunisia, and he set himself on fire in desperation after his goods were seized from him. And it was a sort of last gesture of protest. That is what sparked people's anger. I think a lot of people who actually live with these very, practically irregular ways of selling a few things without a permit, sort of illegal street hawking, basically. A lot of people try to live through that, and I think people felt it as an insult to themselves. They felt immediately affected, and his own funeral started a spark of protest, and these protests just snowballed. They just grew bigger and bigger and bigger, and the interesting thing was that there was no designated leader. They were generally, they were fought through Facebook. People gave appointments on through Facebook mostly, and would convene at a particular place at a particular time, without any specific leader. There were groups who played important parts, like the Movement for Democratic Women, student groups, and lawyers, very importantly, and also artists, who were actually beaten up, and who tried to protest and to stage their anger at the oppression of this regime. I think, however, the way events precipitated was very unexpected. I don't think anybody up to Friday, 14th January, in the morning, I don't think anybody actually thought that President Ben Ali would grab a plane and practically leave the country. I think it came as a shock to everybody. And the violence that ensued after his departure could show that that people were basically struggling, to hold power. So that was, we lived some very hard but interesting times.
Thank you very much for that input, Dr. Cremona. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for questions today. However, your points have proved invaluable, and I wish you the best of luck for your continued endeavors in Tunisia.
Let us now return to our debate. Gorkem, what do you feel are the most notable factors which have triggered revolution?
First of all, we need to understand that these people have been suffering from food shortages, economic problems, and undemocratic regimes for 40 years, 50 years, especially in Tunisian case, when they got their independence in 1962, they only had three leaders in 40 years' time, which explains that there is no democracy, although there is a multi-party system in Tunisia. So, as we can see, multi-party systems cannot establish peace in the region or cannot bring democracy to these people, because we see there is a high level of dictatorship that has been ruled by Ben Ali for 30 years overall. And lastly, I would like to add that no group is watching the events unfold in Tunisia more closely than fellow Arabs, most of whom live under the autocratic governments and are feeling the same economic pinches of black job prospect and high food rises. And therefore, Tunisians and Algerians, I would like to say, and the Egyptians and Yemenis, they are hungry. And of course, the others are behind them.
Thank you, Görkem. Darren, do you feel there will be any economic repercussions to this revolt?
I think that the fact that there is huge or substantial political instability in the region, of course there would be economic repercussions in both the Middle East and North Africa. And this would especially materialize in a drop in the tourism and foreign investments, which would lead to economic underdevelopment, especially of North Africa, where today we talk of rentier states. Foreign investors would be less encouraged to invest in a region which is crippled by political instability. And I was reading in the papers recently that a number of cruise liners and tourist agencies have cancelled their tours for both Tunisia and the Nile and also Egypt. So that would contribute to a great loss of revenue for these economies.
Thank you, Darren. Görkem, one final question. What role do you feel that mass communication tools played in instituting the riots?
They play a prominent and indisputable role in this riots. Over the weekend, the social networking site Twitter exploded with posts from both the Arab world and its diaspora in English, French and Arabic. They cheered on the Tunisian protesters and speculated which Arab leader might be the next to go. Post quite openly called for the ouster of Egypt's president Hosni Mubarak or Libyan leader Mohammed Gaddafi. Algeria is even worse than in Tunis. The police will actually go. Well, it's very vicious, Dahmash says. In Egypt, the president has been there for 27 years in a perpetual state of emergency. With that, they can do nothing in the country. And another Egyptian opposition leader from Al-Gad party declared that they are hoping this will create a domino effect and reach in Egypt. Many people think that democracy can't come from a popular uprising, but we've seen it happen now in Tunisia. It's possible. So, today we see in Yemen, Mauritania and Jordan thousands gathered against the government, venting their anger at rising prices, unemployment and lack of voice in government. So it will definitely affect whole region as a domino effect.
Valid points, Görkem.
Thank you.
Valid points, Görkem. Darren, your view on the same question?
Yes, Hilary. I think that, first of all, we must not underestimate the importance which the communications revolution has played in instituting change in the region. Al Jazeera network has been using satellite technology to bypass the traditional infrastructure and it reaches the homes of various Arab households through satellite, and it has aired critical views of the regimes, and it has served as an eye-opener for the Arabs to realize how corrupt their regimes are and how civil society is weak and it is not instituting for political change. In fact, one of the placards in the Tunisian protests read, "Thank you, Al Jazeera," which ultimately reveals that Al Jazeera has played a prominent role in enlightening the populace. However, there has also been the use of social media such as Facebook and Twitter, most notably, in coordinating the events. then when in Egypt there was the communications blockout, it hindered communication, which was previously coordinated via social media, and ultimately the protesters were disoriented and they were dissented and they didn't remain organized in their moves. Internet penetration is also high in Tunisia. There's a 30% internet penetration rate. However, not all Middle East countries have wide access to internet, and there is also a number of websites which remain blocked. For example, in Saudi Arabia, there are 400,000 websites which are blocked. So there is limited access to information. So the role of mass communication is very subjective in states which are conservative, such as Saudi Arabia.
Thank you for sharing your opinions, Darren. That was Darren Ketkuti. On behalf of the team behind It's Debatable, I would also like to thank today's other participants, Gorkem Dirik and our academic advisor, Dr. Carmen Samut. A special thank you goes out to our phone-in guest, Dr. Vicky Ann Cremona. I would also like to thank our radio technician, Mr. Kenneth Mitzi, and our coordinator, Ms. Joyce Greck. I do hope you enjoyed today's program. If you would like to have your say about one of the topics raised in It's Debatable, visit our website www.mirsa.org.mt. That's www.mirsa.org.mt and click on It's Debatable. I am Hilary Briffa, and on behalf of the Department of International Relations and the Malta International Relations Student Association, I thank you for tuning in and hope you will join us next week. Until then, keep updated. On behalf of the team behind It's Debatable, I would also like to thank today's other participants, Gorkem Dirik and our academic advisor, Dr. Isabel Kalleya.